This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It wasn't until the 1970s that deafness, long considered a disability, began to be championed as an identity. Then deaf culture, with a capital D and capital C, became something to be celebrated instead of repressed. Now some in that community fear that the growing use of prosthetic hearing devices puts sign language and the deaf culture it supports at risk. If deaf children are given cochlear implants in the first years of their life, they may never learn sign language and never come to embrace and continue deaf culture. It's turning into a pretty vicious battle. There are websites, YouTube videos, and even academic papers dedicated to the so-called cochlear war. Some parents have even called implanting kids a form of child abuse. Others call it nonviolent genocide. Science writer Sujata Gupta tackled this sensitive subject in a long-form article for Matter called The Silencing of the Deaf. Sujata, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You write that most of the hearing world is pretty much unaware of the depth and, I think, breadth of deaf culture. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in deaf culture that a lot of hearing people may not even be aware of.
So I think a lot of people, and my editor included, really don't know that deaf culture has its own sort of poetry, it has its own forms of theater. We've been exposed a little bit, I think, through like Linda Bove on Sesame Street doing a little bit of sign language.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, I mean, I certainly didn't realize that there are plays written specifically for a deaf audience, or that more back in the heyday that there were these traveling theater groups that put on deaf culture shows specifically written in sign language and performed in sign language. I grew up in Rochester, which is where the National Technical Institute of the Deaf is located. So I think I had some sort of base level of familiarity with sign language. But a lot of people I spoke to didn't realize that there are different sign languages all over the world. And then within countries, there are different dialects. And because these communities tend to be sort of isolated, a lot of times it's very hard for a group of signers from one school to understand a group of signers from another school.
Is deaf culture something that people would identify themselves as belonging to?
I think so. Definitely traditionally, I think, or traditionally, not looking that far back, definitely a few decades ago, I think people would definitely have said, yes, I am deaf, I'm big D deaf. Now, from what I've seen as I've interviewed people, it seems a little more loose. And definitely one person I spoke to who identifies as big D deaf also said that there's a movement afoot to sort of get rid of that distinction or broaden it out a little bit.
Why is that happening, you know, with so many people seeming like a flowering of deaf culture on some level? Why is it receding?
I don't know if it's receding as much as I think there's this feeling among some people that the deaf community has been too isolated, and that the definition of deafness has to expand to include people with cochlear implants, or even for a lot of hard of hearing people who have some residual hearing and can speak and operate in a hearing world, they've often felt sort of marginalized by the deaf community. So I think there's this hope that maybe the deaf community can become more inclusive as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. And the cochlear implants or prosthetic hearing devices are a big part of what's sort of dividing the deaf community. This is a decision largely that parents make, whether to use cochlear implants. And representing that side of the story, we do have Christine Reed. She's on the line. She's a mother of a deaf girl named Ellie. And her story plays out prominently in your article. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. I want to know from you, most hearing parents of deaf children do choose cochlear implants, but you and your husband really debated whether or not to do it. Why?
Well, I'll start by saying that when you first have a child who is diagnosed as deaf, the first thing that doctors will tell you is, you know, she's deaf, but we can fix that. She can get cochlear implants and she'll be able to hear. And it's just kind of like that's the first option thrown at you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a pro-choice woman.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to make the decision to do something to my child's body mm-hmm. that wasn't, you know, I think it would be different if it was a life-threatening issue. It was something I didn't want to do. I didn't think that was right. And how can I sit there and tell my daughter that, like, you're perfect just the way you are, but we went ahead and did this to you when you were a child. And that's something that my husband and I both really struggled with.
So what did you end up doing?
Initially, we found the one deaf school in Massachusetts that really focused on ASL. She'll actually be graduating in a few weeks from this program and starting preschool. And we were immersed and surrounded by deaf adults, deaf parents, deaf professionals, deaf teachers. We let her be who she was, and we decided initially that we did not want the cochlear implants. We did some very intensive ASL ourselves, my husband and I.
And ASL is American Sign
American
Language?
American Sign Language, yep. And we had classes sometimes up to four times a week, just so we could give our daughter her first language like any other parent does.
A lot of people may think, like as you struggled with, you know, cochlear implants, fix the problem, my child will be able to hear, at least in some fashion. What's the benefit to your mind in American Sign Language over that?
First of all, even getting cochlear implants, we would have had to wait at least a year. And then at that point, that's when they start their quote-unquote hearing age. So my daughter, she was implanted. We did end up implanting her when she was just about two. So now she, even though she's almost three, her hearing age is that of about a 10-month-old. That's a lot of time that we would have missed out and a lot of growth for her. Starting preschool with no language, that's a really, really tough situation to put any child in. So it was important for her to have a language that she can utilize.
I want to go back to Sujata for a moment because, Sujata, you point out in the article that cochlear implants are not, quote, a cure for deafness. Tell us about some of the limitations.
The limitations definitely vary depending on when you get them. So for a child like Ellie, for Christine's daughter, and for a parent like Christine, who's really invested in making sure that Ellie learns to both speak and sign, they're probably going to learn to speak fairly well, you know, if all goes according to plan. When you're talking about adults who get implants, it can be much more challenging, even though the YouTube video seemed to suggest that there's like this miracle cure that you suddenly can be part of the hearing world. In reality, your brain has sort of wired without a spoken language, and so it's very hard to learn to speak that late in life. One of the big limitations that I saw is if you put adults with implants in a very crowded, noisy situation, they'll often struggle to understand what you're saying.
That's the science writer Sujata Gupta. We're speaking about how the growth of cochlear implants is perceived as a threat to deaf culture in general and sign language in particular. Christine is also with us. She's a mother of a deaf girl named Ellie, and her story plays out prominently in an article by Sujata Gupta. What I'm not hearing here is what a contentious issue this is. And it's something I read in the article quite clearly. I mean, I'm wondering about for you, Christine, do you feel like you are put in a position or you have been put in this position where you have to defend your decision about what you and your husband decided with Ellie?
I won't allow myself to be feeling like I have to put in a position to defend myself. Several times in our parent group, when I had numerous deaf parents in with us, the recurring problem, so to speak, with parents implanting their children is the notion that this is a fix and that your child being deaf is wrong. They didn't have any problem with parents getting cochlear implants so long as they allow their children to realize that they are deaf and they are always going to be deaf and this isn't going to fix this. Where I met Sujata at a cochlear implant convention, several of the children with cochlear implants, when they were asked, Are they deaf? And they say, no, they're not deaf. And, well, you know, yeah, you are. You have to be deaf to get the cochlear implants. And so they may not be proud of their deaf identity, but it's certainly not something to keep from your child. And I'm not going to defend my decision any more than I would defend circumcising my son or what religion I raise my children. I don't think it's anybody's business.
First of all, do either of you know which percentage of deaf children are being given cochlear implants at this point?
So it's a really hard statistic to come by, just because I don't think we keep full track of these things. I think there's a statistic from 2000 showing that just above 50% of children in the U.S. are receiving cochlear implants. Many more are actually eligible. If you look at it globally, it depends on what kind of health care the government provides. So in countries in Scandinavia, like Denmark, the implant rate is close to 100%.
100% of those who are born with some hearing disability.
Who are eligible for cochlear implants mm-hmm. will be given implants.
I'm wondering if there might be a possible growth of a new type of deaf culture from the growing population of people who do have cochlear implants.
I think it's possible, and I think it's, unfortunately, I think it's sad. I know a lot of parents that I know personally who have implanted their children who have opted not to go the ASL Big D deaf route. You know, their line of reasoning is, you know, if this is what they want to do when they're adults, then that's fine. They can choose to do that, like a religious situation. Well, we're raising them this way, but, you know, when they get older, they can choose what they want to do. Mm. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. And just because you learn ASL and you teach your child ASL does not mean you lose them to a deaf culture.
Sujata, I can't help but feeling by the end of your article that you think implants, very understandable choice for individuals, but a cultural mistake nonetheless. Am I reading that right?
I wouldn't know if I'd call it a cultural mistake, but I would say that it's really a confusing place. Christine's absolutely right. You do what you think is best for your child. I think if you're a deaf parent, implanting your child or not, it's a pretty hard decision because you want to make sure that they stay in your community. I think as a hearing parent, most hearing parents, Christine and Derek, are so unusual from what I've found in the weight they gave to deaf culture as part of their decision when they chose to implant Ellie. And, you know, you just said that there's this hope that maybe deaf culture can evolve to include children with cochlear implants. Certainly, without a question, it can evolve to include a child like Ellie, who's fluent in ASL. But when you're talking about the huge number of children who are now being raised without ASL, who may want some access to the deaf community, I think that's where it gets very murky, because if you let that community in, then what happens to a culture that's so grounded in language? And I maybe that my own confusion showed by the end of the article, because I don't really have an answer to that, and I don't know that anyone does. I don't think anyone knows just what will happen to deaf culture as time goes on.
Christine, you want to add something?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I just wanted to add on to what Sujata was saying, too, is, you know, because of this article, I received a very lovely email from a deaf man who went to Gallaudet and 20 years ago had wrote a scathing paper for one of his classes about cochlear implants. And basically, you know, hearing parents who implant their children should be charged with child abuse. And he said that he felt so awful that he wrote this paper, and he apologized. And, you know, I kind of just said, this is how you felt at the time. You can't apologize for that. But like, as Sujata wrote, culture, a huge part of culture is language. And if you don't have that language, you know, what ties that culture together, or how do you get along in that culture? I don't think any culture is sitting there saying, no, you can't come in because you have cochlear implants, as a culture at large. Certainly there are still individuals who do feel that.
Yeah, I would have to say that would be my read of some of this deaf culture, you know, where you're not welcome.
But the other side of the coin is, in our particular school that we go to, 47% of the children from 1 year old all the way up to sixth grade, 47% of these children have cochlear implants. Well, if you don't want these 47% in your group, in your kids' culture, you're likely not going to have a deaf school. that's just the sad reality of it. They do need these kids with cochlear implants, or else they don't have the resources to run these schools.
Well, Christine, I'm going to stop you there, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Christine Reed, she is, among other things, the mother of a deaf girl named Ellie, and her story plays out prominently in an article by Sujata Gupta, science writer, and our other guest. Sujata, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, she wrote a long-form article in Matter called The Silencing of the Deaf, and you can find a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. These days, hearing a new musician you're curious about is as easy as clicking on Spotify. In the mid-19th century, not so much. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to go back to 1850 to find out why wealthy Americans were shelling up to $250, a staggering amount back then, to see a singer they had never heard before. Listen for yourself when Word of Mouth continues.